This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and he is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and he created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by his command. Surely his is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely he does not love those who exceed the limits.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. In Brazil, supporters of former President Lula da Silva celebrate his victory over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro following a tight presidential runoff. The U.S. and South Korea kick off one of their largest combined air drills, which Pyongyang has slammed as a rehearsal for invasion. Also, the death toll from the tropical storm in the Philippines hits 98, with over 60 people missing and about 70 others injured. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. In Brazil, supporters of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva are on the streets celebrating his victory over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in the presidential runoff. Official results show Lula secured 50.9% of the votes, compared to 49.1% for his rival. Bolsonaro has not yet conceded defeat, raising concerns that he might contest the results. He is the first Brazilian incumbent to miss a re-election. Lula, in a speech, called for peace and unity. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies. The 77-year-old also sought fair global investment and trade, saying Brazil is back on world stage. South Korea and the U.S. begin their largest ever air drills amid heightened tensions in the Korean Peninsula. The war games involve hundreds of warplanes from both sides and will continue until Friday. The U.S. Air Force says the aircraft will conduct around 1,600 sorties, which is unprecedented. Australia will also deploy an aerial refueling aircraft for the drills. The maneuvers come hot on the heels of South Korea's annual Hoguk drills. North Korea has condemned the air exercises as a rehearsal for invasion and proof of hostility by Seoul and Washington. The country sees all joint drills involving the U.S. as provocative. Pyongyang has responded with test firing of a record number of missiles over the past months. A major tropical storm is hammering the Philippines, leaving serious material damage and claiming lives. Storm Nalgae has now veered toward the northern Philippines. Heavy rains triggered by the storm have inundated rice fields and houses in two northern provinces. The storm first hit the south, where it generated big waves and forced thousands to evacuate their homes. So far, around 100 people have died, nearly 70 injured, and over 60 others are missing due to the extreme weather across the country. The Daesh terrorist attack on worshippers in Shiraz has drawn reactions in Afghanistan, where a deadly attack on an education center in Kabul is still fresh in minds. Afghan people are expressing sympathy for Iranians, stressing the need for Islamic unity in the face of terrorism. We have a report from Kabul.
Wednesday's terror attack on Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Iran's city of Shiraz has saddened Iranians as well as many people around the globe. Among them, Afghans who have been bearing the brunt of blind terror attacks for years say the attack opened their old wounds. They say the tragic terror attack touched their hearts, and they share the grief of Iranian people.
I express my condolences to all Iranians, particularly those who live in Shiraz, for their losses in the terrorist attack on Shah Cheragh Shrine. I was shocked and saddened that innocent worshippers were killed there. I also express my sympathy with families of victims. Iran has not been only our neighboring country and a friend of Afghanistan, but also a second home for we Afghans.
Indeed, it was a horrific and exhausting attack. We strongly condemn it. We Afghans can feel how terrifying such attacks can be. Of course, the attack on innocent people saddened all informed and civilized people. I hope the perpetrators and organizers of the attack are brought to justice and punished.
Afghan experts and activists stress the need for global unity, especially among Muslims, against terror acts. They believe the enemies of Islam and Muslims try to destabilize the region by sowing discord among its inhabitants.
The important point about the terror attack in Iran is that some countries who claim to be superpowers, and we know them as arrogant, try to protect their hegemony in any way possible. One of their evil deeds has been plotting religious wars. In my opinion, the Shiraz attack was one of such conspiracies. I believe the Iranian people and all Muslims should be vigilant and informed, especially in the current situation.
At least 13 people, including 2 children, were killed after a gunman opened fire on pilgrims at the Holy Shrine in Shiraz. Dozens of others were also wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the attack. Many Afghans consider Iran as their second home. Today, people here express sympathy for Iranians, saying they stand with the neighboring nation of Iran. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic always continues its efforts to solve the problem between neighboring Azerbaijan and Armenia, adding that regional mechanisms can help resolve the conflict. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Azeri counterpart, Jehun Bayramov. He said the dispute in the Caucasus can be settled at 3+3 meetings. He was referring to a format which will bring together Iran, Turkey, and Russia, as well as 3 Caucasian countries of Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. The top Iranian diplomat said Tehran is opposed to the deployment of foreign forces to the Caucasus, as it only makes regional conditions more complicated. The Azeri minister, for his part, said Azerbaijan is also against the presence of foreign forces. Bayramov hailed Iran's efforts to help bring stability and peace in the region. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been engaged in the decades-long dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says security is a red line for both his government and the people of the Islamic Republic. Raisi underlined that Iran will never ever allow the enemy's conspiracy to disrupt security to materialize. He then touched upon people's demonstrations to condemn a recent terror attack on a holy shrine in the southern city of Shiraz. He noted that the rallies not only demonstrate the will to firmly deal with terrorists, but also ensure national security. The president said the terrorist attack was part of the enemy's plan to create insecurity and disrupt people's lives by provoking unrest. Raisi reiterated that public hatred of terrorists and rioters have increased, urging authorities to counter the enemy's plots. The UN has held a 2-day meeting on counterterrorism in India. The purpose was to help bring more information on how terrorists operate and to prevent terrorist acts from occurring. There was no mention of Iran, though, which has been a victim of terrorism. And ironically, the U.S. now wants to hold a UN meeting on Iran over the recent riots occurring in the country.
The special meeting has been held by the UN, titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counterterrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional context.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the UN, Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people, we stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice." But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah.
Not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life.
To say that Iran has been a victim of terrorism is an understatement. The MKUltra representative has killed over 17,000 Iranians throughout decades. Other incidents involved the twin terrorist attacks on Iran's parliament building and the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini. And just a few days ago, a mass shooting claimed the lives of 13 worshippers at a shrine. Yet the U.S. and many Western countries have refused to condemn the terrorist incident.
The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. said, given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith. He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. Of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S., the MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012, respectively, of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists had been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested That of the nine nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the U.S. and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the U.S.
Lebanese President Michelon leaves the presidential palace amid a stalemate over who will succeed him. Before leaving office, Aoun delivered a farewell speech to a large crowd of his supporters who gathered at the Babda Palace, east of Beirut. Mariam Saleh has more from the Lebanese capital.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michelon steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. Addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds. President Michelon ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues, but it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy. President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon. Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terrans fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has the largest external debt in the world, and its fiscal woes are getting worse. According to a U.S. Treasury Department report, the U.S. gross national debt has surpassed $31 trillion, edging closer to the statutory ceiling of roughly $31.4 trillion put in place by Congress, limiting the government's ability to borrow. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please. Asia Times had this headline saying, "Clock ticking down on U.S. debt time bomb. Asia Times wrote, with U.S. debt over $31 trillion and U.S. credit market liquidity problems, the risk of a financial implosion is growing by the day. Between U.S. inflation at 40-year highs, the Federal Reserve tightening the most aggressively in 28 years, and the dollar trading at sky-high levels, news that Washington's debt load is nearly twice the size of China's annual output is decidedly unwelcome. For now, the dollar is holding its own with its traditional role as a safe haven for remaining intact. Yet U.S. debt reaching nosebleed levels means the party's over, everyone, says Brian Riddell, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He was speaking for investors everywhere, but it is not just a shortage of safe havens. There are precious few havens, period. In the meantime, a surging debt load will only exacerbate Washington's challenges. The U.S. economy is likely to deteriorate in 2023, with consumer spending and business capital expenditures set to fall, while unemployment is likely to rise, says economist Karsten Berzeski at ING Bank. He added, "We expect a 75 basis point rate hike from the Federal Reserve in November and a further 50 basis points in December," he said, adding, "But mounting concerns about growth and the housing market are likely to lead to rate cuts from the third quarter of 2023. Amid so many challenges, Washington's fast-rising debt load is a new record no one should be proud of," says Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, adding, "In the past 18 months, we've witnessed inflation rise to a 40-year high, interest rates climbing in part to combat this inflation, and several budget-busting pieces of legislation and executive actions." His conclusion is grim, adding, "We are addicted to debt." Also, Global Times wrote, "Large U.S. debt raises concern about more extreme U.S. policies and possible instability." According to a U.S. Treasury Department report released recently, the U.S. gross national debt has surpassed $31 trillion. First, it's clear that the U.S. economy is in far less rosy shape than what many had forecast, with debts now trillions of dollars higher than its GDP, which was only about $23 trillion last year. Starting around 2013, U.S. debt began to steadily outstrip GDP. After 2020, it jumped to about 125% of the year's GDP, quickly soaring up to nearly 135% in 2021. As the rate of borrowing continues to climb, the unhealthy ratio of debt to GDP is expected to continue rising over coming years. On the one hand, the Biden administration hopes to suppress inflation, which will likely drag down the U.S. economy and employment. On the other hand, if the U.S. government chooses to stimulate the economy by increasing debt scale, investors will face greater pressure like rising capital costs, ultimately dampening economic growth prospects. It will be, therefore, difficult for the U.S. government to balance economic recovery and runaway inflation. Bai Ming, deputy director of the International Market Research Institute at the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation, told the Global Times in an interview. He added, "The U.S. debt ceiling has been raised many times, which to a large extent will also have an impact on the U.S. financial markets, objectively playing a negative role by adding fuel to the fire on top of interest hikes." Global Global Times added, the total debt of $31 trillion also indicates that there will be more intense political combat on issues related to congressional appropriations in Washington, which means almost all major federal projects and initiatives will be difficult to deliver, affecting the country's internal economic vitality and its external influence. In addition, experts added, the last time the U.S. debt was this close to its ceiling, the government was nearly forced to shut down. And the increasingly high debt will also harm the basic operation of the federal government. And an increasing debt burden will naturally raise concerns about the ability of the U.S. government to service the debt and even the possibility of extremes in future U.S. internal and external policies, such as provoking volatility, unrest, or even a war-oriented foreign policy to shift or even find ways to renege on its debt, which has indeed happened in U.S. history. This sentiment alone could potentially undermine the full faith and credit of the U.S. The Congressional Budget Office earlier this year released a report on America's debt load, warning in its 30-year outlook that if unaddressed, the debt will soon spiral upward to new highs that could ultimately imperil the U.S. economy, according to an AP report. According to Global Times, the current level of inflation in the U.S. should not be underestimated. Coupled with high oil prices, the energy disputes between the U.S., Europe, and Russia, as well as the Russia-Ukraine crisis and other complex international situations, the challenge of a $31 trillion national debt should be considered in the context of the risky crises currently facing Washington. If the persistent upward trend cannot be resolved, the attractiveness of the U.S. as a global pool of capital and talent will be further eroded, hitting its strength in all aspects. However, it's important to note the reality that the U.S. is accustomed to adopting various policies to deflect conflicts, leaving ordinary Americans and other countries to bear the ultimate cost. The U.S. is not playing the role of a stabilizer in the global economy that a major power should do. Instead, it has repeatedly held others accountable for the consequences when it makes mistakes. As the birthplace of several post-World War II global economic crises, the U.S. could once again become a chaos maker at the expense of economic development around the world, given that the debt, as well as its economic and monetary policies, will all raise the possibility of another global financial crisis in the future. Also, New York Times wrote, America's gross national debt exceeded $31 trillion for the first time, a grim financial milestone that arrived just as the nation's long-term fiscal picture has darkened amid rising interest rates. The breach of the threshold, which was revealed in a Treasury Department report, comes at an inopportune moment, as historically low interest rates are being replaced with higher borrowing costs as the Federal Reserve tries to combat rapid inflation. While record levels of government borrowing to fight the pandemic and finance tax cuts were once seen by some policymakers as affordable, those higher rates are making America's debts more costly over time. New York Times added, the $31 trillion threshold also poses a political problem for Biden, who has pledged to put the United States on a more sustainable fiscal path and reduce federal budget deficits by $1 trillion over a decade. Deficits occur when the government spends more money than it takes in the thorough tax revenue. The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget estimates that Biden's policies have added nearly $5 trillion to deficits since he took office. That projection includes Biden's signature $1.9 trillion economic stimulus bill, a variety of new congressionally approved spending initiatives, and a student loan debt forgiveness plan that is expected to cost taxpayers nearly $400 billion over 30 years. White House budget officials estimated in August that the deficit would be just over $1 trillion for the 2022 fiscal year, which was nearly $400 billion less than they had originally forecast. Biden says those numbers are the product of his policies to stoke economic growth, like the American Rescue Plan. Those figures obscure the effects of the Rescue Plan, which was financed entirely with borrowed money. Much of the deficit reduction Biden is doing reflects the fact that both he and former President Trump signed laws that borrowed heavily in order to mitigate the damage of the pandemic recession. The deficit has fallen in large part because policymakers did not pass another large round of pandemic aid this year.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the political ideology promoted by right-wing Hindu nationalists in India has infiltrated foreign lands, including the U.S. and the U.K. Also, deep ties between these groups that thrive on hate crimes and religious polarization and the Islamophobic forces in the West.
The controversial political ideology prompted by an array of vigilante, political and cultural groups in India through violence is slowly but alarmingly infiltrating foreign lands, including the United States. Hindutva, a combination of Hindu fascism and supremacy, thrives on religious polarization, fanning tensions between Hindus and Muslims and institutionalizing Islamophobia. The recent events in the United States, the astounding rise of Hindu nationalist forces, have fueled concerns that political and religious polarization in India is slowly seeping into diaspora communities.
During the Independence Day parade on August 14 in the northeastern U.S. state of New Jersey, Hindutva groups rolled a bulldozer carrying photos of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister Aditya Nath, the two distinguished poster boys of Hindu nationalism. It was quite symbolic. Over the last several months, the right-wing governments in the Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Gujarat, and Madhya Pradesh have carried out demolition drives using bulldozers, targeting properties owned by Muslims in the name of removing encroachments. Rights groups in the U.S. said they were deeply disturbed by the symbolism, as bulldozers have become a symbol of state repression and violence against India's minorities.
Strain of Islamophobia that was prominent in the 20th century, most prominent in the later half of the 20th century. But what accelerates this entire process is the war on terror and the September 11 attacks, and this kind of creates a fertile ground on which later leaders could use the rhetoric and gain a lot of popularity.
More recently, in another disturbing development, a member of a notorious Hindutva group was appointed to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Faith-Based Religious Council. The group he represents is the overseas arm of the RSS, an ultra-right-wing extremist organization. The Hindutva groups active in the U.S. have reportedly recruited and funded many prominent American lawmakers, including former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Congressman Raja Krishnamurti, Michigan State Representative Padma Kupa, and former Texas State Representative Siri Kulkarni, attesting to the fact that Hindutva fascism has not only arrived but entrenched deeply in America's socio-political fabric.
Islamophobic rhetoric normalized by BJP leaders in India has gradually infiltrated pockets of Indian American diaspora through radical Hindu groups such as the Hindu American Political Action Committee, the Overseas Friends of the BJP, the Indian Business Association, and Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh. It has sparked fear and concern in the American Muslim community, especially with these fascist groups supported by the U.S. intelligence apparatus, as well as the powerful Hindutva lobby groups that wield considerable influence in Washington.
Although the infiltration of radical Hindutva groups into American communities has increased at an astounding pace in recent years, it has a history in places such as New Jersey with a sizable immigrant population. A recent report by the South Asia Citizen Web disclosed financial information and expenditures of at least 24 Hindutva groups and found that seven such groups spend nearly $160 million under programming, which includes sending funds to radical Hindu groups in India. Last year, the New Jersey legislators even felicitated the World Hindu Council, which has direct links with Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the ultra-right-wing Hindu organization based in India.
Hindutva is like, it's a political ideology that is rooted to 19th century Bengal, we can say, but it establishes the Hindus as the original inheritors of the land, and also at the same time it otherizes non-Hindus and creates the non-Hindus as foreign encroachers in the land, and with context to India is basically Muslims.
All these groups with branches across dozens of countries fall under the umbrella of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the parent organization of India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. RSS's growing footprint in the U.S. has become a cause of concern for American Muslims. For instance, the appointment of a leading Hindutva figure to DHS's faith-based religious council recently drew sharp reactions. Rashid Ahmed, executive director of the Indian American Muslim Council, wondered how could a member of a group whose parent organization in India is implicated in violence against religious minorities be a good fit for the position? No one had the answer.
Hindu nationalism has in recent years seen an alarming surge under the Bharatiya Janata Party in India, which rose to power in 2014. It coincided with Donald Trump's tenure as the US president, who redefined fascist politics and institutionalized Islamophobia in the United States. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Trump complemented each other well. Both are affiliated with right-wing political parties, and more importantly, both are rabidly anti-Muslim. So it's hardly any surprise that Hindutva groups mushroomed in the US under Trump's watch.
In September 2019, around 50,000 people gathered in the US city of Houston at a rare mass rally for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It came a month after India stripped the disputed region of Jammu and Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status, sparking tensions. It also came amid a brutal crackdown on immigrants in India's northeastern state of Assam, which left nearly 2 million Muslims from Bangladesh at risk of statelessness. Trump lavished praise on Modi, calling him a great man and a great leader. In February 2020, Modi returned the favor when Trump visited India. The effusive bond between the two leaders was on full display, which many described as a fascist alliance. While grievous crimes against Muslims in India assumed alarming proportions under Narendra Modi, marked by hate crimes, mob vigilantism, demolition of mosques, and sedition laws under Donald Trump, Islamophobia in the U.S. peaked dramatically. He campaigned against Muslims, imposed a travel ban for citizens from Muslim countries, and mainstreamed racist attacks against minorities. A timeline of the megalomaniac former U.S. president's comments about Islam and Muslims is quite revealing, which also explains why and how these radical Hindutva groups gained a foothold in the U.S. under him and later went berserk under his successor, Joe Biden.
The United States isn't the only country to be engulfed by the Hindutva wave. Britain has also seen RSS-inspired mob violence in recent years, particularly in Leicester, which is home to over 100,000 Muslims and Hindus. Most recently, far-right Hindutva groups were accused of targeting Muslim residents in the city in September in a bid to sow seeds of discord in a mixed community. The events in Leicester and other British cities pointed a full-blown rise of Hindutva fascism in the country.
On September 18th, a large mob of right-wing Hindus took to the streets in Leicester, chanting Hindutva slogans. They headed toward a mosque and intimidated local Muslims, which prompted retaliation. Reports in the British media attributed to communal tensions, blaming both sides. But independent observers and eyewitnesses assert that it was Hindutva groups that indulge in violence and vandalism. The Muslim Council of Britain said the violence followed a series of provocations from far-right Hindutva groups over a number of months. Leicester has a 13% Muslim population and a 12.3% Hindu population, and most of the people are ethnically Indian.
As a Muslim myself, I can tell you that there is this kind of fear of speaking about my choices or the kind, and also this need to justify them of why I'm doing certain things. However, the recent, whatever's been happening recently, the protest around the world, it kind of gives us a hope that maybe there will be a change. But at the same time, there's a great fear that, you know, either we'll be misunderstood or we'll be misjudged or something of that sort.
Experts attributed the Leicester violence to violent Hindu extremism across a broader Indian diaspora, driven by the political ideology of Hindutva championed by India's ruling party. Ironically, following the violence in Leicester, India's High Commission in London condemned what it called the vandalization of premises and symbols of Hindu religion, but made no reference to Hindu violence targeting Muslims. According to activists, proponents of Hindutva have had a presence in the UK for decades, but recent events signal an escalation that has given rise to fear and concern within the Muslim community. What makes it even worse is the alliance between the Tories and the BJP.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Muaz Shah, the director at Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Shah. Now, how did the political ideology prompted by the right-wing Hindu nationalists in India reach the US and the UK?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, this journey has started many years ago. There's been an active effort by Indian authorities and the Indian government to connect with their diaspora and to make them as a powerful tool for political purposes. If I can give you an example, everyone remembers about 2-3 years ago when the Kashmir Article 370 issue arose. There were serious concerns of human rights violations that occurred in Kashmir, so much to the extent that even a U.S. congressman attempted to fly into Kashmir to look at that. But before even that, the U.S. Congress took notice of this and wanted to hold a hearing. And the chairman of that committee actually received 96,000 letters, emails from various Indian Americans who basically kind of wrote in so much summary of words that they shouldn't have this committee hearing to look over this issue and that Pakistan is the troublesome and Islamic extremism is the real issue in Kashmir and so forth and so forth. So the level of impact, the mobilization is demonstrative in this one event. I mean, to have in 24 hours, you know, to be able to mobilize 96,000 Indian Americans to flood a congressman's, the committee chairman's office, this is quite coordinated. And I think one of the things that the Indians have been doing, which I think is very interesting, is they've been studying the Israelis. So as we know, the Israeli lobby is very strong in the United States and the United Kingdom for quite some time. The Indians have been taking a leaf from their playbook, and that's basically what's being played. So when we see these type of scenarios, often at times we don't see a condemnation. We see kind of, politicians in other countries looking over this for the interest. Of course, there's deep business interests as well, but there is an effective campaign to keep the narrative that's going on in India and then the Modi regime connected with its diaspora, to use them as a tool.
Sir, Hindutva groups have developed a strong foothold in the US and European countries in recent years. So the question is, has the growing tide of Islamophobia in the West made this possible?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Hindutva feeds into Islamophobia. Islamophobia feeds into Hindutva. There's a very strong correlation of it. There's a lot of studies that have already gone on, and they kind of feed into each other. Obviously, one's promoting the idea of hatred or a fear against some faith, and the other is, moreover, Hindutva, which is promoting its own self as, you know, being the Hinduness and how Hindu are you, which then is connected to the nationalistic feelings. Now, what's really interesting, of course, is that these cultural values, these religious values, it's not like they were invented in the sense that root core of them have always existed, but they're being mobilized now at this point to bring a new era of nationalism and right-wingism that we can see throughout the world, an idea in which people are reflecting of who they are and what's their self-identity. So we're moving away from where the world at one time was moving towards, you know, cohesion, one world government, the United Nations, to more bifurcated sectionalisms in society because of some of the challenges, the economic challenges, the COVID challenges. Anytime we see human society brought with these massive challenges, there's a reaction to it to try to then, of course, save yourselves in so many words. And often the blame is then shifted to others who are minorities or other than you. So it's a re-strengthening of your own identity vis-a-vis also then, you know, supplanting a negativeness on that. So Hindutva, obviously raising their own identity amongst Hindus, and then, of course, suppressing the other. These go hand in hand. And we're quite in such a correlation that we see an explosion of this type of behavior connected. So so much so that Islamophobia is intertwined now with Hindutvas or the Hinduness because the fear of Islam, the references that Hindutva, you know, politicians and, of course, people give about Islam will do this and the fear of Islam. And if you, you know, do this, your women will be this. And there's a lot of issues that, again, you could do many researches in different areas to be able to come with this. But there's a correlation definitely between these two.
So we've seen that anti-Muslim violence has surged since the BJP government rose to power in India in 2014. Now, do you think Modi's alliance with Trump in the US and the Tories in the UK helped Hindutva groups infiltrate those countries?
Absolutely. As I said earlier in my previous response, that, you know, you have to look at where the world dynamics are shifting. Far-right parties are coming to power, nationalistic, because there's a sense of uncertainty in global economics and global health and so forth with this COVID crisis. So what's happening is that these parties generally politically lean into each other. That's a major issue. Another major issue, I would say, is, of course, this rivalry with China, which really plays more so with the United States, more so than the United Kingdom. But here, the United States looks at India as a piece that is an anchor for them to contain China, as they do with Japan as well in the similar capacity. And so this is something that for America is extremely important. So that's why they look over some of their crimes and some of their situations that are happening to a certain extent. Vis-a-vis when you look at some other countries, if you put them in the same situation, they face certain, revealing, concerning responses that the United States gives to them through sanctions or through, you know, a reprimand or so forth. So the standard is not the same because there's a political advantage that they want to keep with Modi's government. And Modi understands that. And this also has to do with business. Business is also really big. You know, we have, of course, India being one of the major increasing trade players in the world, particularly due to population and consumption, particularly with the explosion of the IT market and outsourcing that started many years ago. And that, of course, has expanded. And business interests have entered the United Kingdom and the United States. You know, you look at Tata Group that ended up buying Land Rover and Jaguar. So these things indicate that there's strong, deep-rooted influences that, of course, have an impact. And we're seeing that impact right now put in the political sphere when we see with this recent selection of the British prime ministership. With a man who basically is very strongly identifies himself as a Hindu. And then, of course, he has had some very strong comments against Islamic extremism. I mean, he basically said that, you know, which has become, quote, a significant terror threat in the United Kingdom. Now, how significant, and was asked that, what do you mean by this? He says, people with extreme hatred to Britain. What's that going to translate to? That's going to basically translate to Islamophobia being activated, and then people being racially profiled, people being subjected to human rights abuses, and these things will happen. In fact, the current Prime Minister, Rishi, was selected, and he was asked about that, also Liz Truss, about what they're going to do about Islamophobia, and he was silent. He didn't have a response. So this, again, going back to your earlier question about how these two go together, it's a natural cohesion. Because it's about pride of putting your culture, your Hinduness above others, and somehow a sense of superiority, which sounds very similar to something that we've seen in Germany a few decades ago.
And finally, sir, let's talk about the recent incidents in UK as there were brutal attacks on Muslims and their properties in Leicester attributed to the far-right Hindutva groups. So does this point to the rise of Hindu fascism in the country?
Absolutely. And I think at this point, it's at a pinnacle. That event that happened in Leicester is something that really shows that the impact this is having of this relationship, what it's coming down to. And, you know, there's some things that's very interesting, and I ask people to go back and look at those videos again. You notice every one of those Hindutva groups that were chanting and marching throughout the streets in the United Kingdom, they were wearing a mask. So there is an element of, and, you know, we can bring in the whole excuse of COVID and all that, but in reality, there was not one single, Hindutva supporter who was chanting and going and marching in the streets of the United Kingdom that wasn't wearing a mask. That means that there is a sense of, you know, whenever you have your identity to be hidden, there's a serious concern there that the actions a human being takes upon that is different. And the Muslim community response was very interesting because they were not wearing masks. They were open about who they are, who their identity is, and their rights to protect what they believe in. And they were not going to allow Islamophobia to be spread by these groups. And that's basically what they're doing. This whole marching, chanting was sort of an intimidation tactic. And I think what's also happened, which is very interesting, and I think this should be observed, is now people are realizing outside of the South Asian region, particularly outside of Pakistan, how threatening this may be, particularly the